Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis. And today, more explorations of the cultures of consciousness. I've been writing an encyclopedia entry recently on the counterculture and the occult. So it sent me back to some countercultural texts and indeed the origins of the word counterculture, which comes from a book by Theodore Roszak. And in that book, to follow the bouncing ball of associations that often drives my mind, in that book he talks about Norman O'Brown, a once very celebrated thinker who sadly has fallen into neglect these days, who wrote a very crazy book called Love's Body in the late 60s that was pretty hip. You know, he's an intellectual professor, but it's a very poetic, crazy book, and indeed it is in some sense about madness. And in a way, as far as reading beautiful, strange, and intellectually compelling works that capture something about the 60s, I don't think you can do much better than Love's Body. And just to follow the bouncing ball a little bit farther, Norman Brown, and what Brown was doing was trying to think about Freud in a new way, try to think about the psychological, psychoanalytic aspects of ourselves, about the shadow, about the death drive, about Eros, in a new way that would help explain and break through to a different kind of society or a different kind of being, one that in some ways you could see that was being stirred up in the counterculture, in this attempt to birth a new, more alive, more poetic, more crazy kind of way of being with all the difficulties that entails. And late in his career, Brown wrote a wonderful essay, which, among other things, is what I think is the best essay about Burning Man, although it's not about Burning Man, but it illuminates Burning Man in a way better than anything, called Dionysus in 1990. And he's wrestling with this problem, again, of like how you try to understand society once you really take on that Dionysian emphasis on dream, on embracing the darkness, on dismemberment, the kind of crazy stuff, the craziness we have as individuals, the craziness that is clearly in society, and not thinking that you can get away with it, get away from it, but also think coherently about it and see what it means and follow how it could lead to at least a more engaged and lively society. And in that text, he talks a lot about one of my favorite 20th century thinkers that everybody should wrestle with, Georges Bataille, a very peculiar man, a medieval librarian, medievalist librarian in Paris in the hip days, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, but also a crazy perv, and a wild man at writing. And he did some marvelous books on eroticism, on the relation, on medieval mysticism. Very powerful, kind of brings a surrealist kind of sensibility to discussing the theories of religion. And one of his key ideas, which I think is one of those ideas that if you wrestle with and you start to take on, it really changes the way you see the world and yourself, was this idea of excess. And what he thought was that there's always too much. Here we are on this planet. We're being bombarded by cosmic rays. Biology is like thrusting itself through our bodies, through our labors. And then we have this crazy human society where there's always this sense of too much. And he didn't think that just had to do with capitalism and modernity creating too many technologies and sort of the overproduction that seems to characterize the last couple centuries. He thought that was endemic to life, and that the idea of perfect balance or harmony with nature was an illusion, because neither nature nor us is ever harmonious except for moments. And instead, what we have is a problem of what do we do with too much? What do we do with the too muchness of our lives, the too muchness of ourselves, the too muchness of information, of production, of hungers, of desire? And what he saw was that in societies, if you look at them, one of the ways to characterize or understand societies is to figure out what do they do with the too much. And the great example here is the potlatch, which was a tradition that the Indians in the northwest coast of the of North America would turn to. They lived in very abundant economies. They didn't have to work very hard. There was delicious salmon running all the time, and deer and foodstuffs. They didn't have to work very hard, which meant they got kind of rich. And then what do they do with it? And so they would have this potlatch where the whole thing was about useless expenditure, just consuming crazily, madly, outdoing in a rivalrous way the other lords by throwing ever bigger, ever more indulgent parties. And this idea for Bataille became a way of understanding how people in general deal with their too muchness, because it sounds a little bit like consumer capitalism. And so then it gets a little tricky, because you're like, well, there's clearly a problem here. We don't really want to keep this thing going just the way it is. But maybe our normal idea about, oh, we can stop it, we can get more balance, we can kind of control it, maybe that's the wrong way of thinking. Maybe it's about finding different ways of dealing with the fundamental problem of excess. So with all of these ideas bouncing around and the associational pathways set in motion, I'm happy to say that today I'll be talking to an old friend of mine, Ed Phillips, one of my great intellectual partners over the years. Just to say a bit about him, he's a free software evangelist, theorist, and practitioner, and he says he's though a one-time expert, he's now a novice. And he tweets at Faustrol, Faustroll, but he's one of these people, there's thousands, tens of thousands, millions of them, who think amazingly and do great stuff outside the limelight. So I'm really happy he's going to join me today to deal with some of these issues. But first we'll bring on our co-host here in Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. How you doing, Maja?
I'm doing good, Eric. How are you?
Pretty good. Hey, I have a little bit of a cold. Do I sound different today?
You sound a little fuzzy, but not too bad.
Good. I don't want to have that. You know, sometimes people sound sick, and you're like, oh, God, I don't want to. Well, you know, so sure. I was just thinking, I mean, since you're sitting on the sort of lore source for us here sometimes, talking about Dionysus, can you give us a little, give us some tidbits? What's some stuff about the lore and practice of this great god that have stayed with you or have been points for your own reflection on life?
I will. And actually, I can think of a really good Georges Bataille quote, because I love Georges Bataille. And one of my favorite things of his, I think, sums up the idea of Dionysian Bacchian things. Georges Bataille said, he loved the fact that people greet each other with a smile. And he said, only in human beings could the greeting of a smile be so friendly and yet such a clear threat as a result of flashing our teeth, which are used for consumption once we see each other.
No, that's wonderful. It's funny. I think we talked about this when Mark Derry was on the show. We talked about teeth a little bit.
Because he had that whole chapter in there. Yeah, because the thing with Dionysus, you know, he gets himself consumed and eaten alive. He's torn limb from limb by these women that just rip his body apart, in the same vein that all of the dying gods, the resurrecting gods, any of the food gods, right? You got any of the gods that are grain gods, or like, you know, Dionysus is the grapes, the wine, the kind of alcohol guy. So any of those guys, they get torn apart and they get eaten. So the symbolism that they stand for when they get that idea of consumption, and like you said, the potlatch, that's really the same esoteric principle as communion. So, like, it's the same thing, the potlatch that the Native Americans do to share in the blood and bodies of these gods is the same idea when we all get together to go to church on Sunday to have the communion, the Eucharist. That's what you're doing when you're having these communal, like, over-the-top eating parties. You're imbibing yourself with the spirit of the thing that you're eating.
Yeah, that's great, because that's also a thing about Bataille, where in some ways he's rethinking in the most perverse and pagan way some fundamental ideas in Christianity. But even in the secular world, we experience that. I think we all sense that, like at a feast, you know, when we have a party, but where there's food and everybody brings food and people are drinking too much and you're eating and there's just, you know, like a crazy holiday feast without the oppressive neurotics of parents around, which is my favorite kind of holiday. And, you know, we taste that even in our secular lives. But with all this, it's great. Let's bring Ed on the show. Ed, thanks for joining us here on Expanding Mind.
Hi, Eric. How are you?
I'm good, man. I'm good.
Good.
So yeah, I want to let's stay on this this idea of excess a little bit. I mean, it's like how do we experience that? You know, where do you see that you know, operating
right.
in your life in the world?
That's a great question. I think one of the simplest and most clear ways and most obvious ways of talking about it, and hardest to refute, would be to say that we suffer from an excess of emotions, all of us, all human beings do, an excess of emotions or what they call proto-emotions, an excess of affect and sense. And this is an issue in every human being. How do we deal with this constant affective experience that we're experiencing? And there seem to be two major trends in pretty much all people. One is avoidance, and the other is the attempt to reconnect to the emotional life.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's it's one of those paradoxes. I think anybody who's done any self work, like, you know, going to, you know, in real therapy, not just sort of trying to modify the irritations, but actually really diving in, or other kind of spiritual work or meditation. It's like the farther you go, the more the territory opens up into just the depth and intensity and contradictions of our, you know, of our own experiences. It's like the world that's opened up by dreams is, you know, it seems almost kind of infinite, and it can be sort of overwhelming. It's like, oh my God, every step I take, I think shouldn't I be getting more integrated and more controlled and more clear, and yet the opposite often seems to, in fact, generally seems to happen.
Right. So how do we develop one way I'm asking myself this question is, how do I develop a robust capacity to be confused, to be overwhelmed, to actually allow myself to experience the excess as an excess, without always avoiding that fact. So appreciating the fact that I do have many strategies of avoidance, I also have tried to cultivate and develop a capacity to repropose or reconnect to direct experience and direct emotional experience.
What's the connection between that? I mean, that seems like a good point, is that, you know, first you say, on the one hand, to really start to be okay with this primary sense of confusion or these waves of affect that seem to come out of nowhere, and to go into that, and you're like, well, how do you do that? And then there's this idea of really being more directly with the emotions you're having, even if they're rage or fear or dread or feeling like you're an idiot, or, you know, all these things that are kind of woven into our days often. There seems to be a connection there. What is it that you gain by being more intimate with the emotion?
Well, you, for one thing, you gain a vividness of experience and a sense of actually being alive, and that's actually quite difficult sometimes, and we our defenses can be too robust. You know, we can be on the side of boredom And then we'll have to reckon with that and be honest with ourselves about that as well. So there's a concern for truth and for life in our own individual lives that kind of guides us. And then I would say this, I would use this simple term from Keats called negative capability to talk about developing a capacity to be in confusion and in the space of not knowing robustly enough so that we can grow and learn. Because if we're stuck, that's why I say that I can't afford to be an expert anymore, because I need to learn. And every time I'm stuck in the place of being an expert, I can't learn.
So let's stay on this idea of, like, even in your own work. I mean, one of the things that, you know, we were talking before, I was saying, well, you know, what have you been doing lately? You do a lot of, you know, software development, and you're in the situation that's constantly changing. Like a lot of people, we work in knowledge environments where the environment is always changing, or your business is, you know, in many ways the same way. And there's this constant not knowing, this constant change. And it's difficult, you know, particularly I find as I get older too, is that I'm like off, sometimes less willing to throw myself back into, you know, beginner's mind is innocent and sweet, but beginner's mind is also confused and crazy. And I'm curious, like, how have you, like, in your own work life even, started to open up to that as a way of understanding what you do?
That's a great question. One of the things that I say, and this is kind of, it might sound kind of strange, but this is where I live, is that I spend a lot of my day in the pain of ignorance. And it's painful and it's hard. But for me, it's absolutely necessary to do what I do. I can't do it well. Or in a well enough fashion if I don't develop a robust capacity for feeling the pain of ignorance and experiencing it. And that is passion. And that's about the one thing that I'm still passionate about is actually learning and growing. Does that make sense?
That's a tricky thing, though, because it's such a fine line when you have that kind of intelligence to not let it grow to obsession. I mean, seeing for myself, I'm one of those people that likes to know everything, right? And it's not even like I want to know it to be an expert or feel like, you know, I'm some kind of thing in the world. I just have to know stuff, which, you know, like you said, it's when I don't know something or I'm feeling that place of ignorance, it makes my brain go kind of nuts. So I'm wondering if for you, do you have that, like, just kind of obsessive compulsive kind of thing where you have to get into stuff to try to, like, get to the answer? Or is it more like for you just, I mean, what do you mean by the pain of ignorance? Is it, you know, just like you don't feel comfortable not knowing something? Like you can't just let go and float into it? Or what kind of form does that take for you?
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that's a great question. It's actually, maybe perhaps I could say it's in suspending the compulsion to know, and it's in developing some patience with being in confusion that then allows some economical way of understanding something to emerge. So a lot of what I do is just, you know, I will take in a lot of things. I will sort of drown before I can swim. And then I will let my mind slowly digest something, and I'll give it lots of room. So I'll spend a lot of time in these domains that I'm not necessarily knowledgeable in, and I will develop enough competence to actually get something done in that space. But I will suspend the sense that I actually really know what I'm doing per se, because I have to actually get something done in a certain domain. But I try to preserve that ignorance. And in fact, the deeper I go into these things, the more I open up, yet new more vistas of even greater ignorance. So I can't afford to tell myself that I'm an expert. I need to be competent, but I don't need to be an expert. Does that make sense?
No, that would totally. I mean, we think about it. I mean, it's definitely one of the diseases of our era, and it has been for a long time. I mean, I mentioned at the top of the hour, you know, reading Theodore Roszak's book, which I reread recently about the counterculture. Great book, really insightful, very interesting. Not always. I don't agree with some of it, but it's a very insightful thing. And he already at that point in the 60s is bemoaning this kind of culture of expertise. And you know, there's all sorts of political effects that has and cultural effects. And we sit here and we watch these guys go back and forth, but we don't often acknowledge how much that undermines our own capacity, the capacity of our own intuitions or our own intelligence to kind of come up with good enough answers, or maybe even good, great answers that are unpredictable, by in some sense being willing to not be an expert, even while you still have to get stuff done, which is of course most of our lives anyway. And I know sometimes I get incredibly oppressed with the sense that I have to deal with something, like make some kind of financial decision or a medical decision, is totally along these lines, and you're like, I'm not an expert. I don't know anything. Oh, my God. And then there's this world of experts out there. And whether or not it's a good idea to go talk to somebody or talk to someone who's been studying this their whole life, that's not the question. The question is how I internalize, how I deal with that state. And I think that living in a culture of experts, we just develop this bad habit of going, oh, I don't know. Okay. Somebody else knows. Someone else is like, oh, let me try to pass the buck and put, you know, and not just be in the confusion. And you use the word patience, which I think is really, really key to a lot of this stuff. I mean, when you talk about how do you be with your difficult emotions, whether they're confusion and the need to know or other aspects of this excess that's coming through us, and it's, there's this trick. It's like you don't want to be completely suffering in it so that you freak out, because often, you know, if you're just overwhelmed by one of these emotions, you freak out. And yet you don't want to just have some control mechanism you use to deploy it. And that's a lot of what our society also does. Oh, you feel this way? Well, use this cognitive behavioral trick, or use this drug, or use this thing to control it. And you're like, ah, control, that's not, it's kind of avoiding the issue. But patience, and even that sort of idea of like almost like a patient, like you're holding, so you're taking care of someone, you're like, you're intimate with the thing that's happening, but in some ways you're resting with it rather than being, you know, diving totally into that. How does one learn that capacity? How in your lives, either of you, have you learned that capacity to be patient with the difficult stuff, not running away, but also not quite submitting to it entirely?
Right. That's a great question. And some people are calling it the capacity to contain, patience, a kind of presence with a kind of being with one's experience as it is. And an interesting thing is, I could say also what kind of things are we going to give over to the experts? Because there's a lot of things I would just love to give over to the experts. Like, I don't really want to know a lot of how certain things work. But then when that thing is intimately concerned with my actual life, I can't afford to give it over to the experts. So issues like religion, issues like money and my connection to life, I can't afford to give those over to the experts. And so I struggle to understand these things in terms of my own psyche and in terms of my relations with others. And one of the things I've discovered is that, and I'm not the only one, many people have, is this idea that the psyche is a place of tensions and a place of conversation both, and it's a conversation with different parts of the psyche and with other people. So it's almost like I'm trying to develop an ability to converse with myself and converse with my problems in a way that I can both be aware of the conflict and of possible ways that I can enter into conversation with what's actually happening in real time in my life. So I can listen and I can also articulate with some competence in some domain that I've spent time trying to understand, or with another person that I'm trying to have a conversation with, or other aspects of my own psyche that I'm trying to listen to and enter into conversation with.
I just wanted to read. I just pulled up the famous Keats line where he's writing a letter, and he talks about he's talking about Shakespeare in particular, but just generally artists. And it obviously applies to broader people as well. And he describes this capacity of negative capability, quote, that is when man is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. And that's willingness to be in that and those contradictions. And the other thing you said right there about that emphasis on strife, the strife in the self, and then the strife and struggle in the world, is I think there's a real tendency today, especially for people who've been, you know, working in, with spirituality and meditation and Buddhism, and who are discontent with the contemporary world in a lot of ways, that there's this sort of model of a kind of like what you're striving for is a kind of peace or a kind of balance or a kind of sort of harmony with things. And there's a strong drive, this idealistic drive towards that kind of world, that kind of experience. I think that's obviously very helpful and very much part of the picture, but there's been, I think, a real damage done by an overemphasis on those idealistic models, because they prevent us from kind of demonizing the conflicts that not only we're in, but the conflicts that we are, the tensions, the uncertainties. And so there's like a sense of like, oh, there's something wrong here. If I can like meditate more or be more at one with my experience or be more accepting of everything in the world, then I'm not going to have this kind of tension. And that doesn't mean you don't change the tension or become more integrated person or become a more peaceful person. But what it's done, I think, is hamstrung us in our ability to really embrace that condition as an opportunity, as an invitation to more intimacy and more depth rather than as a problem to be solved.
Yeah, I like that. We could also think of it as a kind of counterpoint between an ability to feel tension and being overwhelmed, and so that would be the negative capability part of it. And then once we've gone into that space and felt the confusion, then we do get this, do get these harmonizations, these relaxations, these moments of peace and grace that come out of that. But to have those in a real way, in a way that feels absolutely real and that touches our hearts, we paradoxically have to have the faith to enter into the confusion and enter into the durability. enter into the confusion with letting go of our preconceptions and risking something in ourselves, and then we'll get the grace.
Yeah, that seems like that idea of that kind of faith is really key. That kind of risk, that kind of trust, and we can even do it in the smallest kind of ways. you know, little things you don't, you know, whatever, you don't know how to do some household chore, you don't know how to da-da-da-da, and yeah, maybe you'll get some advice from an expert, but at a certain level, you're just kind of throwing yourself into it, and you can start to learn, oh, wow, actually, a lot of times I do something I don't know how to do, and I can, it works out fine. In fact, it's something wonderful happens, something creative, like, oh, my God, who knew, or cooking without a cookbook. That's a, to me, seems like a totally key thing. It's like right there every day, you're cooking almost every day, you know, and yeah, you can't do this all the time, but sometimes, you know, you take some stuff, make food, see what happens. Sometimes it's not even that good, but you're like, there's a process of growing, of throwing yourself into it, that we're surrounded by opportunities to do that, and you learn that ability, and then you can face other things. But we got to take a break right here. Okay. And we're talking with Ed Phillips on Expanding Mind, Eric Davis and Masha Daou, and we're talking about all sorts of stuff, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Masha Daou. We're here with Eric Davis, speaking with Ed Phillips about making sure that you have enough stuff and how much stuff you need to make sure you feel all right. And I feel, Eric, before the break, you were talking about that a little bit, and a lot of this stuff, like, you know, feeling competent, and being able to go into confusing situations. I mean, to me, a lot of it is just about, like, it's interesting to think about with the Dionysus stuff, too. Like, how much stuff do we need in order to not be afraid? Like, there's that whole thing, like, with the unknown, and then you're afraid. You don't know what's going to happen. Anything can happen. Oh, my God, everything's confusing and weird, and I'm not really sure what's going on. But then you can, like, get these little tidbits of information, and then you're totally cool. So you can have some situation that could otherwise, you know, escalate in your mind into some kind of terrible thing. But if you just know that little tidbit of knowledge, you just have that little thing, then it's like, okay, now I'm totally cool. So it's that fine line between how much do I need before I'm afraid and have a total freak out. And it's interesting, Ed, and I was wondering, like, I mean, how much do you think that is just purely psychological and comes from people's subconscious of that, you know, kind of tendency in order to go into confusing situations or places they don't know? Do you feel like people that are better at that, is it really like because they just have more information, or is it more like a kind of subconscious drive that some people are just better able to control that part of them or dialogue with that part of them or talk to that subconscious part that just wants to, like, kind of have the freak out? I mean, where do you think that originates from?
That's a great question. I think I'm looking at these in terms of capacities. And so actually, I think we can develop capacity. And so what some people call this capacity for reverie or the capacity for containment, or even the dreaming function, is something that we can develop, and that we all have it more or less, but these are things that actually are capacities that can be developed. And one of the interesting things about human beings is that we are not fully developed. Our minds are feeble, and our capacities are very limited. And so when we recognize that, we can start to actually develop more capacity in those areas.
Well, let me ask you a question just to get to the dream stuff in a different way. Like, I can imagine somebody, you know, listening to our conversation and going, great, yes, we're not fully developed, we can develop new capacities. Why wouldn't I be looking for capacities of, like, you know, analytic insight, self-control, discipline, diligence, you know, all these other kind of things? Why would I want to develop this capacity for dreaming, for reverie, for the imagination? Like, I can understand why that might be fun, But in terms of like living a richer or more productive or more engaged life, it's not really clear to me exactly what does developing that side of reverie and dream, developing that capacity, how does that play into the things we've already been talking about in terms of dealing with these conflicts and moving forward into the conundrum of life?
Right, right. Well, one of the ways that some people are talking about it is in terms of emotional digestion, that in order to actually understand our emotional experience, we need to develop a capacity to free associate and to dream and reflect on our emotional experience. So one way of looking at reverie would be as a kind of way to develop a capacity in the waking state to interact with other levels of consciousness that are always present, but that might be drowned out by more active states and more stimulated states of mind. So that capacity to digest is probably emotionally is probably one of the most important things that we can have for our personal health. I don't know how adaptive that is in terms of external society. In fact, it might be not adaptive. But certainly, I think it's pretty solid to say that it's vitally important to our emotional and even physical health, probably.
Well, what are some concrete practices that have worked for you in terms of bringing those worlds together? Because it sounds like one of the things you're talking about is how to make that realm of reverie or dream not just be off in another world where, like, at nighttime I have dreams and then, maybe I write them down or now is my, when I take a walk, I think about, I imagine things. But you're trying to, like, weave that sort of into the fabric of the ordinary and the everyday. So what are some things that you've done that have, well, develop your own capacity to be in touch with that world?
Yeah, I think it's vitally important for me in my everyday life because I use it as a way to actually develop software, come up with things I'm going to do. A lot of what I do is actually done in reverie. And then I will lie down and think about something or sit back and meditate on something for quite a long time before I actually sit down and type on the keyboard. So it's absolutely important to me and what I do. I'm not sure how to actually communicate that to you in this conversation. That's part of the, how do I talk about something that's so personal and yet so vital, it seems to me. It might be assumed, like just to have the capacity to read poetry and have an imaginative response to a work of imagination by another person requires an imaginative capacity and further develops it.
Well, the answer is the problem in the sense that these things, there's some kind of, there's something very intimate and very singular about our different ways of connecting with that imaginal realm. And so you can't really, if you could codify it and say, oh, do this, 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 and this, and that's, that's a lot, again, what you see in the New Age and self-help manuals and, all the sort of reign of self-psychology of, like, here's the plan, here you do this and do this, and then you have people who, like, kind of, they feel like they want that, and so they go out and they read somebody else describing how to do it, whereas, in a way, what the answer is that it's kind of a, not a solo journey, but one that you have to make kind of within, finding your own sort of modes of reverie. I mean, I think one of the ways that I do it is that I start to think about childhood and those states of imaginative intimacy and even, you know, some of the kind of more disturbing parts of the childhood's mind, and then kind of really resonate with them, get close to them, and try, and then start to get a taste for them, so they're familiar to me. Like, oh, it's that space, like that one time in the field when I was 8 years old or whatever. And then notice, like, when it is during my day that I have a moment like that, where I'm just walking down the street and I see a dog, or I'm, you know, I go into the park and there's a certain moment, or there's some weird guy in the restaurant, and it's just something kind of disturbing about it. And it's like, oh, wait, there's something there. There's some kind of, you know, intimacy with a really different way of being and thinking that's also not, like, extraordinary. It's just another part of the ordinary that kind of hides in the cracks, so to speak. But, you know, even just saying what I just said, that's kind of, it's a very individual, personal thing. It's not like a recipe.
Right.
How about you, Maja? How do you cultivate this kind of sense of ordinary magic or reverie in your life and work?
Yeah, it's practice, you know, to open a space to allow it to be there. I really agree with a lot of what Ed said, and it's very difficult to translate. It's like, how do you tell someone that if you open up a spot for something to be in your mind, it can be there a lot easier than if you don't open it, you know? But it's true, and it is something that has to be cultivated. And one of the things I was thinking about a lot when you were talking, Ed, was like how martial artists train. And it is. It's almost like a math equation with imagination just as much as it is with your body. If you, you know, do push-ups 100 times a day for 3 months, you're going to be better at being able to just drop and do push-ups whenever you need to do them. If you sit there and allow the capacity for your imagination to increase, then when you're met with something like a poem or a song, after developing that capacity, the impact that it has and the depth that it goes to is much deeper than it would have been possible to do before, you know. And it's through practicing. For me personally, I mean, I read books, I do art through music, meditation, like for having magic happen in life. It's just about increasing my ability to perceive it, right, paying attention more, and then you can, it just comes in. You got the spot there, and it just shoots right in there.
That's a great way of talking about it. I really like that. I think it was Keats or someone based on Keats that talked about being a gardener of the mind, being a gardener of the brain, or of creating these kinds of bezels so that wisdom can land in them.
Yeah.
And staying open. So always creating things that are open to modification or open to further understanding, and watching out for those places where what we know has actually become an impediment to having us discover something else.
Yeah, in meditation, you know, sometimes there's this image that I've come across people talking about it, where, which I like because it's also very human, and you can see it developing with just the evolution of human beings, is you're basically like sitting in a clearing, and you're on the edge of a clearing, and there's the clearing, and you're like, who's going to show up? Is an animal going to come by? Is there something going to happen? Something going to shift? Is there going to be a sign? But you're just, there's this kind of space of an emptiness, but there's a watchfulness as well, like a readiness to recognize and to go with something that might emerge, and that sense of openness is really key. And in a way, it gets us back to the first topic about excess, not only in our personal lives, but even more importantly, in some ways, in society, in economy, and the world that we're in, is that there's not a steady state. It's not a closed system where everything is rationally accounted for, and then, oh yeah, there's a little bit of excess you got to deal with, some surplus that you got to deal with. It's like, no, the situation is fundamentally open. That was Bataille's vision. Is it like, you know, again, solar ray, you know, we're getting like the sun is moving through the planet and all these planetary processes, and it's just making too much. It's always spilling over the edge of the cup. And that openness is also the openness that allows real novelty to come up in our personal lives, in our imaginations, and not having the ego who wants to control and like make things happen all the time, and learning how to do that. But I do want to do a little shift here. You know, we got about 10 more minutes or so to talk a little bit about economy, because you think a lot about, and you tweet a lot about economics or whatever. And I know it's a big subject, but just in terms of the things that we've been talking about today, about excess, about negative capability, about being in conflict, is that how has that shifted the way you think of yourself or the way you understand this totally crazy economic situation that's going in that we experience on a personal level and global level? And so it's, in some ways, how has that shifted your understanding of that domain?
That's a great question too. I one of the things that I, you know, in talking about this idea of the psyche as the place of tensions, one of the oldest discussions about that tension actually goes into a discussion of Eros as the child of scarcity and wealth, or excess and scarcity. So, you know, working across that tension, or working with that tension, that's evident also in the ways that we've thought about economics previously, and then the way that Bataille tries to turn it on its head. You know, most of contemporary economic theory is about an economics of scarcity, and then Bataille's is an economics of excess. And so thinking about those as a tension, how can we see that on the one hand, those of us who are not suffering from radical scarcity, and there are many, many people on the earth that are suffering from tremendous deprivation and scarcity, how are the rest of us dealing with the just surfeit of excess, of stuff, of ideas, of things? And how are we also suffering from a certain amount of scarcity, scarcity of capacity, scarcity of time, even emotional scarcity? Because you'll see a lot of people in the supposedly developed world suffering from kind of emotional deprivation, even though they're inundated by, you know, just ridiculous amounts of stuff and even wealth and all these kinds of things. So how do we negotiate that as people? That's how I ask myself. You know, that's what I ask myself. And Norman O'Brown in that essay that you referenced just simply says, what do human beings really want? What do people really want? What really matters to us? What the hell are we doing with all this stuff? What's the point of all this? And I don't have an answer to that. I'm just amazed by it. I'm stunned by the truth in that question. So I'm looking at it in myself, and simply for me it comes down to this emotional wealth, emotional excess, because that is true of every human being who's capable of speech at all, or capable of any kind of discourse or anything. Every single person is suffering from or benefiting from, depending on their perspective, emotional excess and emotional wealth and emotional richness if they're willing to suffer their own experience long enough to get there. But unfortunately, a lot of us, and including myself, I have to include myself in that, we're not yet capable of suffering our own experience in some way. Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense. I mean, it's maybe a little bit, it's often discussed. It does make me think of how, you know, one place where all of us know excess now in a way that we didn't even 10 years ago is the surfeit of information and just the complete too muchness of the internet, which is, and in a way, it's kind of a nice situation because we all know it so well, you know, that anything you're interested in, or you know, music or film or any or the answers to a question about your, you know, medical health or options for, you know, you know that you can go online and there's just too much. There's just and at some point, you know, and then we all develop strategies and we all develop ideas that may or may not be conscious about how we deal with that too muchness. But what your question made me think of is another way of thinking about the sort of distraction factor that people talk about is that, because in a way the internet and our mediascape and communicating with people through Facebook and all that stuff, it so models that too muchness, which in some level we always have to deal with, that it's easy to let that be the place where we think we're going to come to that richness, whereas it can really, you know, also impede the ability, the emotional ability to just be with where we are, which might require a kind of solitude or a kind of shutdown on that level so that something else may happen. And I mean, and I don't, you know, sometimes I feel like, well, that's too dystopian or it's too Luddite. But it does feel sometimes like the too muchness of media and communication kind of overwrites the space where we would be able to experience that more intimately and come to terms more intimately with ourselves. And so there are a lot of emotional cripples, and I know I'm one too, like you say. I mean, I know how I use this stuff too as a way to distract and avoid. I'm curious how you think about these issues in terms of the kind of too muchness of the information society.
Yeah, that's a great question, too. One of the things is, you know, you can divide the Internet, too, between, on the one hand, the news cycle, which is meaningless in so many ways, and then the longer-term trends that are around and deeper ways to think about these issues that have been around for a long time, and you don't have to worry that somehow it's you know it's going to disappear or everything's going to change all of a sudden. The news cycle is an internal return of the same often trivial set of distractions, and it's filled with a lot of propaganda, and it's attempting to stimulate emotions without leading to any understanding. And if you, on the other hand, if you look a little more deeply, there are ways to think and talk about the conflicts and tensions in society that are going to be around for a long time. And so if you work steadily towards trying to hold those tensions and understand them, you probably made good use of your interaction with society. Because you've found some way of navigating that's going to do you well, regardless of what you know blip on the news cycle is happening at any given time. So it's all in how you use the media. I don't think the media determines anything for us. I think we're more determined by our own preconceptions and predilections and, you know, what the Buddhists might call attachments, than by the media or by even, you know, society per se. We're in interaction with it, certainly, but it's our attachments that we're seeing.
Sort of manifest on that level. Well, we only got a couple of minutes left here. I just want to make sure if there's any lingering thought that was still wanted to be expressed.
Okay. Yeah, maybe I could continue with that, because each one of these words that we use is so filled with such a penumbra of associations that it's dangerous. So when I say attachment, you know, I want to speak positively of attachment too, because it's so important that we have attachment, and there's so much denial of desire and genuine attachment in our society that there's a danger when I talk about what the Buddhists call attachment, that people are going to say, "Whoa, just don't be attached," and that's somehow going to solve the problem. That's just going to make you into a robot.
Well, speaking of the robot, I think our robot soundtrack is indicating that we're at the end of the show. So thanks, Ed, for talking with us on Expanding Minds.
Thank you, Eric.
All right. Ed tweets.
Bye, Maja. Thank you.
File scroll. And for me and Maja, to all you out there, keep your minds open.